The first thing I want to do tonight is introduce Marina Rosara, who's right here. I see her.
Hi.
Joining us with the Community Living Campaign, and she's going to briefly tell us what CLC does and how you might be able to take advantage of some of the great things they do.
Yeah, thank you so much, Dennis. Thank you for having me here. Usually in person, when we can be in person, the Community Living Campaign in the Inner Sunset is an exercise program 3 days a week in the community room of St. Anne's Church, St. Anne's at the Sunset. We always have exercise and afterwards social events, and our main goal is to cultivate connections to help seniors and adults with disabilities to age and thrive at home. Since the pandemic, we've been busier than ever, and our main goal has been to kind of translate our in-person activities online. And so for almost a year now, we've been exercising together, offering free classes in technology, in art, in exercise, in resources. So I just want to remind you of our website. If you want to be on our mailing list, you can write me and I'll send you a calendar. But right now, I really want to tell you that what we've updated since the last time I've, I always pass on to Dennis our calendar. But right now, we've really been updating around the vaccines, where seniors can go. You may know a senior that can't get to a vaccine or can't get, there's a big digital divide going on. It shows you how you can help your neighbor as well. So we update that all the time. Every time we hear from the Department of Public Health, we update it. And then this, our latest adventure, we received a grant to help with the digital divide. And we're really trying to get seniors tablets in their hands. Our main goal is to find people who are isolated, and it's come in handy more than anything this last year. And so not only will we pay for the internet service throughout this and give a tablet, we'll also help to train and help people feel comfortable so they can have virtual doctor's appointments. They can talk with their families. And then also, they can come to some of our events. We're really getting out there. Our community has grown, even outside of the Inner Sunset in San Francisco. And so I just wanted to let you all know that and reach out to you. Judy Goddess is here. She is our Inner Sunset connector who helped start the program. She has a monthly event called Drama with Friends. At night, we have evening events and music. So if anyone has any questions, I'm going to put my email in the chat as well as our website, and I'm happy to put you on our mailing list. But our main goal really is to continue to find seniors who are isolated and need our help, and to foster neighbors getting to know one another, and just reach out and let me know if you have any questions.
Marina, did you put your contact info in the chat room?
I'll do that right now. May I ask Judy if she wanted to say a word or two? You're fine. I don't mean to put you on the spot.
I'm fine. I think this is great. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks. I just wanted to highlight Judy. She's the reason we exist in the Inner Sunset. So thanks so much for letting me jump in here last minute. I'll put all of our website and my email in the chat. Thank you, Dennis.
Yeah, you're quite welcome. So our main presentation tonight is all about congestion pricing. And it's going to be somewhat of a hot issue in the future. But before I go ahead and say a bunch of wrong things about it, I'm going to introduce Rachel Hyatt, who's the Deputy Director of Planning for the San Francisco County Transportation Authority, not to be confused with the MTA. So, Rachel, it's up to you.
Thank you, Dennis and Sharp folks, for having us. So yeah, our board is the San Francisco County Transportation Authority, which is the Board of Supervisors wearing their SFCTA hats. And our agency, we're a small agency, we're not MTA, so we're not the transit operator. We're a small group of folks with a couple different responsibilities. One is a state designated responsibility for long-range transportation planning countywide and congestion management countywide. Our second role is the administrator of the half-cent sales tax for transportation that San Francisco voters approved in 1989 and then in 2003. So those are our two roles, and that's who oversees us. And the role of congestion management and long-range transportation planning is kind of the reason that I'm here, also with my colleague Paige Miller, who's in communications with us. And the topic is congestion pricing. And I guess the first thing to say about this congestion pricing work that that our board has asked us to do is that they asked us to undertake this work pre-pandemic. So it was back in 2018-19 when we were at record congestion levels in San Francisco due to population growth, job growth, and ride hails were some of the reasons that the congestion levels at that time surpassed even the previous boom, you know, prior to the last decade's recession. And so our board asked us to look into whether congestion pricing would be a good tool for San Francisco to manage that congestion. And if so, how could it be done fairly and in accordance with San Francisco values? So we started that work, and of course the pandemic hit, and we've made a number of changes to our approach given the situation that we're in. I think certainly congestion pricing is not something that is appropriate now, not in a recession, not when, you know, the traffic levels are so lower, not when we don't have the transit service that we need to be an alternative. Long story short, we went back to our board over the summer last year for guidance about, you know, continuing on. And the feedback was, let's continue this study, a feasibility study, so that we can be prepared with this tool if it's something that's of interest, looking down the road in the future, when our economy rebounds again. We do expect our economy to rebound again the way it's done in the past, and so that we don't return to congestion levels like we had in 2019, we could be prepared with a tool such as congestion management if we need it in the future. So when our board asked us to look into this policy matter, congestion was the top concern at that time. And this is a photo as an illustration of the issue. So we had were doing a lot of things together with MTA, BART, et cetera, to improve transportation downtown. But the number of vehicles on the street sort of was an impediment. This photo shows a part of Mission Street that has a bus lane, but you can't see the bus lane, and the bus isn't able to take advantage of it because of the number of vehicles on the street making legal right turns. And so the thinking behind an idea like congestion pricing is to complement investments in the supply side, in transit improvements, transit service, to reduce the number of vehicles during peak periods in the most congested areas. So we're talking about peak periods only during the week, the rush hours in the congested parts of downtown, with the objective of making the most efficient use of the limited downtown street space that we have. We know we can't expand the amount of street space that we have downtown, but we can use that street space to move the most amount of people that we can in the most efficient way. So that was the primary goal. There were other goals, though, that our board has called for and that other departments within the city and our regional transportation commission have identified. And those include safety. So San Francisco's Vision Zero strategy, that is reaching zero serious and fatal collisions. And our climate action strategy to achieve San Francisco and the Bay region's greenhouse gas emission reductions from our state goal. All of those strategies call for a significant vehicle demand management strategy like congestion pricing in order to reach those really ambitious goals. The last concern that our board expressed to us very clearly was a concern about equity and affordability. And they gave us a few bits of guidance on that. Number one, that equity needs to be a key component of the process of developing a congestion pricing concept for San Francisco. So what would a fair congestion pricing program look like, and one that doesn't exacerbate the unaffordability that low-income households already experience in San Francisco? And secondly, can we address the disproportionate impacts that our low-income communities and communities of color experience as the effect of traffic? And this map shows San Francisco's high injury network. So these are the streets that have the most fatal and serious injury collisions within San Francisco, and overlaid with San Francisco's low-income communities and communities of color. And there is a correspondence where people who live in the Tenderloin and the Soma experience a lot of vehicle traffic and the collisions that go along with that. They also, not shown in this picture, but a similar story, they also experienced the pollution impacts of those vehicles also disproportionately. But yet they drive less. And this is 2019 data. So we know that travel patterns are changing now and might continue to change into the future. And that's something that we're monitoring. As of 2019, so pre-pandemic, this is information about the people who were traveling downtown San Francisco during commute rush hours during the week. And the plurality of people who were traveling during that time were in the highest income category. Of course, there were people of all incomes traveling during that time. And among the lowest income folks who were traveling, those folks were mostly taking transit or walking or biking. So they were experiencing the delays, such as in the Muni photo I showed before. But that said, there are these share of folks, about 13% of folks that based on our data collection, who are in the lowest income categories and who are driving. And so those are the folks that our board conveyed, you know, we need to make sure that a congestion pricing program doesn't negatively affect these low income folks who need to drive during the peak periods. Another bit of information that we summarized from that period is looking into the question, well, can we address this problem just by further managing the bridges, right? So the bridges where folks are driving over from the North Bay or from the East Bay, we don't have a bridge similar to that to manage the South Bay traffic, but is it the regional drivers who are really creating the congestion? And what we found is that it's not primarily the regional driving. There is some of that, of course, but a lot of the driving happening downtown is actually coming from somewhere within San Francisco or even coming from within downtown itself. And this does include ride hail vehicles such as Ubers and Lyfts, who are, you know, might come over from the East Bay or from the South Bay in the early morning, and then continue to make drives within San Francisco or within downtown throughout the day. So San Francisco is one of a number of cities in North America that are looking into the question of congestion pricing, but right now there is no North American city that has congestion pricing in place. New York will be the first North American city that has congestion pricing. Their state and city has approved a congestion pricing program for Manhattan, but that isn't expected to actually start operating until 2021 or sometime after the pandemic recovery. So they, similar to us, approved their congestion pricing program before the COVID pandemic, when congestion was at record levels, and now are readjusting because of the changes in travel patterns. I think some folks may be familiar with some of the more well-known examples. London is a well-known example. Stockholm, maybe folks don't know about. They are interesting because their program started as a pilot. And I think somebody asked the question about a ballot, about, you know, questions of, well, what is the approval process for something like this? And does it go to the ballot? Stockholm did that, actually. They started their program as a pilot, and they put it to the voters in 2006, 6 months later. And their voters actually voted to keep it because of the benefits that they saw. So that's an interesting example. So, but it is a new idea. For North America. We have the congestion management goal that our board has asked us to focus on. And I guess, as I mentioned, talking about congestion management, we're talking about a future when economic activity returns, we're no longer in a recession, when there is a transit alternative and transit service is able to rebound. So we're not talking about something that would be implemented or appropriate for the current time. Our study effort is expected to continue through later this summer, probably after the board recess. We have identified some policy options for detailed analysis. Questions like, who ends up paying it? You know, who would benefit from it? What would the benefits be? How much would people end up paying, and for what types of trips? And so we're doing those projections now. We're also adjusting them for COVID because we know, excuse me, that travel patterns have changed and are going to have a lasting effect. So even looking at 2025, there are various ways that people will still be telecommuting, or jobs maybe haven't returned to the same levels that they were before, all of those types of variables. So we're looking at it with a COVID recovery lens to try to understand what, you know, 5 years from now or 10 years from now might look like. We want to have a sort of real significant round of outreach later this spring, summer, when we have the results of that work, and invite people to understand the trade-offs, weigh in on those, and then bring draft recommendations to our board before their recess. So as Board of Supervisors, they have the August recess. So we are striving to bring draft recommendations before the recess, and we expect we'll need to revise them based on the feedback we hear and bring revised recommendations after the recess in the September-October timeframe. some of the outreach, and Paige is here because she's a senior communications manager with us, and she leads a lot of our outreach activities. I wanted to share some of the things that we've done so far, and which, you know, we could do again this time around, and are in some ways, some of them are, or are planning to do this again this spring, later this spring, if your members are interested. We have a policy advisory committee. So the West of Twin Peaks Central Council sits on it. So Steve Martin Pinto has been the representative sitting on that. It's a 35 member body, and it is, you know, consistent with the equity directive of our board. It's half made up of community-based organization representatives from San Francisco and the region's low-income communities of color, organizations that serve those communities. That's one way that we get guidance and feedback. Another way that we've incorporated San Franciscans and regions perspectives on congestion pricing is through co-creation activities. This is a photo from one that we did before the pandemic last year started. We were able to do a few in person, and then we needed to switch it to remote. But it's a partnership with a community-based organization. We compensate folks and the organization to come together and design their own version of congestion pricing based on their own perspectives and values of what is fair and how to manage traffic in a way that's fair. So folks would choose a fee structure. So for instance, one of the main things we heard and that people chose was a progressive fee structure, similar to the way, you know, a progressive income tax would be designed, for instance, so that it's, the fee varies based on income. And would also, folks would also choose the investments that the revenue should go to, what sort of improvements need to be in place on day one, you know, before the price incentive would be in place. We shifted it to a remote version after shelter in place, and upcoming this spring, we do expect, we're planning for everything to be remote as well this spring for the outreach that we do. But we want to do another version of that type of co-creation work with communities. This is one that CCDC, the Chinatown Community Development Center, did in partnership with us at one of their buildings in Mission Bay, where they, you know, brought together folks living in that building to the community space in the building, and folks were socially distanced, et cetera. So there's ways that we've been able to partner with organizations to set it up in a way that complies with social distancing. If not that, we have also used text and just a text survey as a way to get input. You don't have to have data plans, you know, or, you know, an MMS phone. You can just use SMS as part of that in language. We could, if you're interested, you know, talk about the best ways to, over the spring and summer, reach your members as we, you know, continue through this study process and make sure that your members' perspectives are incorporated and heard by us and our board. So far, the things that we've heard is just a, the whole spectrum of perspectives on whether or not San Francisco should even consider this idea, you know, all the way from this idea could never work for San Francisco and would never be appropriate, you know, all the way to we should have done this 10 years ago, you know, before the last pandemic. So perspectives range across the board. I think the most common concerns that we've heard are about affordability, and about another sort of cost of travel that might be involved for people in a San Francisco that's already so expensive, concerns about whether transit could really be a good alternative to driving for some neighborhoods. You know, the point that some neighborhoods, especially in the outer neighborhoods of San Francisco, transit isn't the type of a good choice that it is for somebody like me who lives in Dubose Triangle, and you know, I'm very close to downtown and the transit is different. And then lastly, but not an exhaustive list of the concerns, but about concerns about whether an additional price during the peak periods would dissuade people from patronizing the businesses or going to Union Square, say for theater or shopping and things like that. Among the things that we've heard that people are interested in are basically from like neighborhoods like the Tenderloin, who experience the impacts of traffic and want there to be less traffic going through their neighborhoods. So the health and the safety benefits, and from people who are taking transit that is often stuck in transit, in traffic. So what we've done so far to incorporate those areas of feedback is that we have built a means-based, you know, a progressive means-based structure to any fee design, so that the fee would be exempt for the lowest income people. So there would be no fee for the lowest income people, and that people below median income would only pay a fraction of it, a percentage of it, and that only the highest income people would pay the full amount. We also heard a lot of interest in, you know, pursuing a similar type of approach to transit fares. So right now, the set of folks who qualify for Muni's Lifeline fare, it's a very limited set of folks who qualify for that discount. We heard a lot of interest in, you know, whether a means-based, a broader, sort of more progressive means-based structure could be applied to transit fares. So we tried to build some of that in. We have also built in the feedback about transit performance into the design of the use of the revenues. So we would prioritize, the revenues would go back into improving transportation and access to downtown, with the first call being on those services that are crowded. Even today, there are services that are crowded, even though we're in a pandemic and we're getting pass ups. But especially in 2019, there was a lot of crowding in many parts of our transit system. And then there are definitely neighborhoods in San Francisco that don't have the quality of transit access to downtown that other neighborhoods do. And so putting the resources towards those areas that, you know, disproportionately have worse access. This, please don't feel like you need to memorize this. Like, if you don't already have my slides, I'll make sure that you have them so that you can have this and all of the other information that I've been presenting. But this is a summary of what some different congestion pricing policies might look like based on what we've heard so far. And so the scenarios are in the columns and different policy aspects are on the rows. And all of them include a means-based structure to the fee, with the lowest income people being exempt from that, and people who are earning 120% of the area median income would be the folks who pay the full amount. We also have heard, and other cities that do this also discount folks who have disabilities, so drivers who have disabilities, similar to the way that there's parking relief for those folks, people who live in the zone. Different cities that have done this handle this different ways. New York is still considering how they will handle this, but we are looking at different options for people who live in the zone. In all cases, it makes sense for there to be a cap on the daily sort of fee that anybody would end up experiencing. And then lastly, Uber and Lyfts, the ride hails, the TNCs, They contribute to congestion significantly, or they did, you know, pre-pandemic. And so we have found that the congestion fee would need to apply to them differently and would need to be a per trip congestion pricing fee instead of a per crossing. And maybe I'll just, because it, I guess, isn't called out in this picture, but we're only talking about peak periods of the weekday. So the AM rush hour and the PM rush hour. So none of this would apply during the middays, during the evenings, during the weekends. That would just be as it is today. Investments of the revenue. I guess I talked about this a little bit. We need to address the crowding that would be projected and then use the revenue to address inequities in quality of service. The last thing is the boundary. And this is an area where we're still working with neighborhoods to continually revise this so that we're being very careful about not like splitting neighborhoods while also capturing the on and off ramps that need to be captured. This is what that boundary looks like right now. We've also looked at a version that only goes up to Broadway in the north, but it's another area where we're looking for feedback and working with community-based organizations. So this is our study where we're at right now in the step five, where we're putting together a projection that takes into account the COVID situation and looks at, well, who would end up paying, who would end up benefiting, who would end up being impacted, and, you know, what would cost be for folks, what, you know, would the traffic reduction be projected to be. And we want to come back, share these things, hopefully with you guys if you're interested, and more of your members if you're interested, before we bring recommendations draft to our board before their recess and then revised afterwards. And this is our contact info, this website here, and this email here. And I know there's a bunch of questions, and so it was just, I think, have a discussion about perspectives and feedback. And I really appreciate you all having this this session to spend the time on this topic. So thank you so much.
So Bob Plantheld has arrived, and so I'd like to have him give his presentation, and then maybe we can take all the questions at the end of that. So, Bob, are you with us? I see you're unmuted, so that's good.
Okay. So the idea of this was initially and primarily to reduce pollution and make life easier by having less noise as well as less pollution, which all sounds great. And to say, whoops, I'm not so sure, I don't think I like this, is like opposing motherhood somewhat. Let me bear up. I think there's a lot more that needs to be done on this plan before it's really ready to submit to legislature, the supervisors, the transportation authority. The idea of a $12.50 per trip minimum, because there was another higher figure, I think that's going to be too high for many people to really swallow or pay easily. Especially if when they get downtown, they also have to park somewhere. And I had suggested, why does it have to be that high? Partly it's because a whole lot of other new additional uses were added to the original plan of reducing congestion, reducing pollution, reducing noise. Now there's money for transit, money for if you will, human powered, whether it's bicycles or scooters, there's money for a variety of things. That's driving the cost up. And I don't know that that needs to be part of congestion. If you already have a fee of as I was saying, $5 or $7.50 that people will swallow or pay, wouldn't it still mean some people would decide to take Muni or carpool or something, making it easier there for people to then bicycle? I don't see that there's been a economic price analysis, price sensitivity on the $12.50 being something that people who have to drive for their own reasons, that they're willing to pay, that they won't try to cheat. They won't try to do all sorts of things that cause maybe congestion in areas close to the boundaries, which happened some years ago when commuters from the San Mateo County would drive to park near West Portal, then take Muni in. And suddenly West Portal got congested in its parking. And that's what worries me about the $12.50 price. I think people are going to drive close, and then suddenly maybe they'll take Muni in, which I think works against the idea of congestion management. You just outsource it. You spread it out. I think there's also a problem with the boundaries. And I'd written an extensive analysis, detailed comment about that last fall. The boundaries were somewhere along 16th Street, running, you know, to the bay. And what I pointed out was inside the boundary are two major low-cost supermarkets, Foods Co. and Smart and Final. Well, if they adjust the boundary to 14th Street, Smart and Final is still inside the boundary. It's inside Division DuBose 13th Street. Well, if you're trying to help low-income people with a discount on the fare, on the fee, they're still going to have to pay it to get into Smart and Final, or maybe to get into Foods Co. But beyond that, there's something just outside the 16th Street boundary. Mission Neighborhood Health Center is a community health clinic for people in the Mission. It's for low-income people, and it also has an evening HIV/AIDS clinic. So if there's people inside in 16th Street, whether it's Soma or some part of Mission Bay, Chinatown, and they're for one reason going to Mission Neighborhood Health Center that's outside the boundary, they're going to have to pay. Even with a low income fee, it's going to add up. So I think the boundaries, I'm going to say it, I'm not sure that the people who set those boundaries really, really understood, did a survey of the facilities that low-income people use and need, whether it's a health clinic or a supermarket. And to me, there's another reason why it's just needing so much more detailed work before the TA can come up with a plan that people can honestly say, okay, I buy it, or no, I don't buy it. Right now, to me, it's indeterminate. And yet, when sometimes these public forums are held by the MTA or the TA, you'll get lots of people calling in because they believe in the ideal. And I'm trying to stress the practical, that it's just not ready for prime time, if you will. I don't want to belabor this, you know. It's 7:40. People have other things in their lives they want to do. I'll stop now and then let our moderator ask his own questions. And I sent in a bunch of questions in advance so that the moderator can consider those separate from my comments. I'm on the line for as long as you need.
Thank you, Bob. I do have all your questions standing by here. I'm going to take some of the questions off the chat room first. Someone has asked that we specify the hours of peak periods. Rachel, I guess that'd be for you.
Yeah, they would be, we're assuming 3 hours in the morning and 3 hours in the evening. So that's like 6 to 9 in the morning and, you know, 4 to 7 in the evening, as an example.
Another question here says, if an Uber driver drives from outside the city and drives in the city most of the day, is she considered from outside the city?
Yeah, great question. So it's considered by trip. So when she drives in from outside the city, that's a regional trip from outside. And then each trip that she makes within San Francisco is counted as a San Francisco trip.
The question is, congestion pricing take into account the size of the vehicle? Would a small car pay as much as a stretch limo, for example?
All the questions are going to be great questions. So other cities do consider that. Milan is an example of a city where they have congestion pricing, and it's all oriented around the size of the vehicle and the pollution level of the vehicle. That's how it's structured and designed. A whole long list of different fee structures depending on the type of vehicle. At this time, we have not proposed something like that. We've only talked about a distinction between, you know, passenger vehicles and ride-hail vehicles.
Question is, will the board let voters vote on this?
They could do. I mean, that's up to our board. I would say about the approval, so our board, the mayor, San Francisco cannot decide ourselves whether they would want to do congestion pricing. It would require state legislation to authorize it. So it could not happen just from a San Francisco decision. It would have to have state legislation to allow it.
Another question, are freeway on and off ramps part of the zone?
Yes. So folks driving on, off the freeway from a off ramp into the downtown would incur the congestion charge if it's during the weekday peak period.
A few years ago, SF Muni provided free bus fares to all minors under 18. There are also discount fares offered to seniors and disabled. Has SFCTA explored the possibility of free or very low fares on all public transit? Then everyone would walk a few blocks and hop onto a bus or BART. There would be no motivation to drive.
So as part of this work, we've looked at expanding the number of people who would receive a discount to Muni. We have not included, and actually we did do some analysis to say, would something like this, would congestion pricing produce enough revenues to afford to, replace all of the fare revenues that Muni has, and it wouldn't. So I think that, a fare free Muni would be a separate conversation from congestion pricing, from the vehicle price incentive side.
Here we go. Another one. How are residents who live within the zone impacted by fees? SoMa has both large luxury high rises and large BMR complexes.
Right. So the first question is whether, the first aspect we've proposed is that low-income people, whether they are residents of the zone or whether they're residents elsewhere of San Francisco or whether they're residents elsewhere in the Bay Area, they would have either an exemption or a discount depending on their income. So it's the higher income folks who would be, the full fee would apply to them. Other cities that have congestion pricing have handled this question differently. London has a significant discount for residents of the zone, regardless of their income. High income or low income, if you're a resident of the zone, you have a significant discount. Stockholm does not do that. So different cities have done it different ways. We are looking at that. We are looking at a resident discount, even for folks who wouldn't qualify based on their income, to understand what's involved with that, and to you know, just be able to share that information with our board and with the public.
Long, do you plan any favoring legitimate taxi cabs as distinct from things like Uber and Lyft?
Yes, I'm glad you asked that. So taxi cabs would be exempt, like transit and shuttles.
Okay. Let's see, it says, are these monthly fees or per trip? I think you mentioned that is a per trip fee.
Correct.
The other question, if I enter the zone, I need to exit the zone, would be one fee or two?
Oh, thank you for asking that. We are also looking at that difference too, because other cities also do this differently. Different cities do it one way. London does it just one time. Stockholm is for both directions. Right now, what New York is looking at is for both directions as well. I think there's trade-offs with either way. So we're looking at both and want to share the different effects of doing it one way or the other, you know, with the public and our board.
The garages are encouraging people to park their cars before entering the city. One question I can't figure out how it is here, but some areas have areas in the center where there are no cars other than local not allowed. They have large parking garages surrounding a larger central city with very good transportation between the garage and center of city. Not sure I read that right. Did that make sense to you?
Well, it does. I mean, that sounds kind of like what Stockholm does.
What about service workers who have to travel to clients in the area? These are such things as house cleaners, pet walkers, house sitters, contractors, plumbers, and so forth. There are also many supply houses for these contractors in Soma that are visited in the early morning. Also, service workers use businesses in the area like coffee shops, grocery, lunch, and everything. Are these workers to use the area? Will payment just add cost to these already underpaid workers? Service workers need a free pass.
Yeah, I do hear that concern. And we're actually talking with a bunch of different labor unions on Wednesday about a lot of those questions that you brought up. So right now, and this conversation will still be ongoing, because I mean, I agree with the questioner that this isn't a tough issue. It's not the intent from our board to increase costs for vulnerable business, low income people. Some things that are a starting point is the means-based discount. You know, a low-income landscape person, you know, for instance, or house cleaner would be able to take advantage of that, and also a cap, a daily cap. I think that's just a starting point, and we need to continue to understand the needs of those service workers and come up with other options.
Another question here, and actually this was something that I was curious about. What is the tracking mechanism, billing mechanism, and privacy protection? So technically speaking, nuts and bolts, how does this work?
Yeah, so glad you asked. So the most basic way that it would work is using your fast track. So if you're using a fast track today on the Golden Gate Bridge or the Bay Bridge, this could work with the same thing. I think like the Golden Gate Bridge, which today doesn't have any toll takers. They just have, they take your fast track when you cross. And then for people who don't have a fast track, they take a photo of your license plate. That would be a way that it would work. And that's the type of technology that London uses and Stockholm uses.
Let's see. Uber and Lyft contribute to about 40% of the congestion. Can you limit the number of Uber and Lyft vehicles?
Yeah, San Francisco is not able to. The state has the authority to regulate them. I think we have looked at this question of, if Uber and Lyft were to go away, would that meet the congestion reduction goal? I mean, it would, because they contribute more than 15%, of the trip making. I think our another question we're asking is, like, are the ride hails in some way worse vehicles than just any vehicle? So aren't all vehicles driving downtown contributing safety impacts and pollution impacts? It's, I think, a debated question, and there's different perspectives on that. We are looking at treating the ride hails differently because we know their travel behavior is different, while also including an incentive for privately owned vehicles that could switch to a different time of day or a different mode.
Next question. The progressive pricing scheme based on four income levels seems hugely complicated to implement and administer, as well as being prone to abuse. Do any of the European cities have such a complicated fee structure? And they said, I do agree that if you're in phase five or six before finalizing recommendations, it seems very far from ready for prime time.
Yeah, that's a very good point, because the European systems are not where the European systems have complexity is at the type of vehicle, because they're very oriented around the level of pollution being emitted by the vehicle. So Milan has this huge complicated structure that is based on the type of vehicle, how many axles it has, how much, what engine type it is, you know, the pollution from the particular engine type. So it's very complicated that way, but it's very simple for private vehicles, and privately owned vehicles. London is also likewise. London does not offer discounts based on income. So this would be, I acknowledge the point that it's more complicated than an existing transit fare structure based on income, or our existing toll structure. Like today, we don't have on the bridges any differentiation for different tolls for low income people. So I think that's fair, that it is more complex than anything we have today. And so one of the things that we will need to share with our board is, what would that take to make that happen? If we've heard that's what people would require if San Francisco were to do something like this. So we are working on understanding, well, how could that be actually done in practice, and what would it take so that our board and the public can consider whether that's something they want to do.
Just kind of passing over ones you sort of covered. As suggested, this proposal is premature. Our population is not growing, rather it is shrinking. Many will continue to work from home even after COVID. So the premise for this proposal is out of date and premature. SFCTA needs to, I'm moving on to the next thing. I guess that's it right there. I think you sort of addressed your backtracking from where you thought you were a year ago.
Yeah, well, so definitely. So we don't think that congestion pricing is appropriate in conditions like we have today, where we don't have transit is at a fraction of the capacity that it had before. And so many people are working from home, and there's so much unemployment. So no, it's not something for today. It's something, just to share a story, I guess, our board folks may remember, Bob, I'm sure, remembers that our board asked us to look at this same issue 10 years ago, more than 10 years ago, in the last boom, right before another recession. And the same thing happened that has happened this time, which is that we were at record levels of congestion in 2008. Then there was a recession and we weren't. So they said, okay, never mind. And then the congestion came back and they said, oh, maybe we should look at this again. So I think right now it's about, thinking about an idea that could be ready 5 years, 7 years down the road, when congestion starts returning to avoid getting back to that level, and not like it's something for today.
Okay, we got plenty more here. Will this affect workers going in and out of City Hall?
Well, it would, according to the zone that we have recommended, which would include Civic Center.
Their projected cost to administer this very complex system.
Yeah. So there's different cities have had a range of experience with this. When London first started, and it took them like a very large percentage of the toll revenues to administer their system because the technology was in the early days. They were basically the first European country that ever did it. So since then, the administrative cost has come down for them significantly. We are assuming, we're looking at a range. So we're assuming, a 20% administrative cost, to the program, and looking at ranges plus or minus to try to be as conservative about that as possible.
In terms of outreach, please share your slides with us. One thing I will mention, this video will go up on our Facebook page. So, but I think maybe Rachel, it's already on your website, I believe, SFPP.
Well, it is, but let me send you the slides so that you can just have them and anybody can have them.
Okay. And it says here, I recommend that you contact organized neighborhood groups similar to SHARP. These are established entities throughout the city with existing constituencies of interest. The city has an official list of these you can access. It's a much preferred method to put together ad hoc groups, rather than putting together ad hoc groups or whoever responds to surveys.
Thank you for that tip.
I'm reading along, you could probably read along with impact of businesses within the Northeast sector. What will be the impact on the businesses within the Northeast sector with congestion parking and pricing? It's expected that somehow the businesses will not be adversely impacted. I know I actually thought of that. There's a couple of businesses that are just barely within the sector there that I would now have second thoughts about going to. How is that going to affect those businesses?
Yeah. And the businesses do have the same question for us, right? Because they don't want to lose any people coming to them. And so one of the questions that we're looking at is whether we'd be able to and would expect to have the same number of people coming downtown, but just by different modes. And that's really the point. In a broad sense, it's that we don't want to have fewer people coming downtown. That's not what we want. We want the same or more people coming downtown, but just more of them with other modes or in off-peak times if they can. So that's something we're looking at. We're also looking at how can the program support businesses in, the other things that draw people to downtown San Francisco, which is for the experience, the experience of being in downtown San Francisco for the theater or for shopping, can we bolster and reinforce those types of things to make sure we're getting the same number of people downtown? It's just not necessarily the same number of them driving.
Okay, we got a whole lot more mess. So I'm going to shift over to some of the message that Bob Plantheld sent in earlier. Number one, tourists from all around the world rent cars at SFO or Oakland Airport. How will they be notified so they know they'll face a $12 or higher fee? Similar, how will tourists staying in families in the suburbs, as well as suburban commuters and suburban shoppers, be notified they face this fee or $12 or higher?
Mm-hmm. Publicity for something like this will take a whole campaign, right, of publicity to do. And I think that we've can learn from the experience of Golden Gate Bridge, for instance, when they converted from having toll booth takers to not having toll booth takers, some lessons learned about how to communicate those and make those arrangements with rental car companies and so forth. As folks maybe have read in the newspapers recently, you know, the Bay Area bridges are all going to follow suit with that and become electronic tolling only without toll takers, you know, gradually. So I think we can learn from those, you know, communication and publicity efforts and improve on them.
All right, now moving back and forth here. How will low-income commuters and tourist drivers know? While we just mentioned that, the current boundaries are meandering along 18th Street, 16th Street, and more low-priced food stores at Food Co. and Smart and Final are in the boundary. We mentioned that earlier. How will low-income drivers have to pay the discounted fee?
Yeah, that's another good question. And there's options for this, right? So we want to consider all the options. We don't want to have barriers to people getting the benefit that they deserve. So the most basic way would be when you get your fast track, like today, if you have the experience of getting a Muni Lifeline discount, right? You sign up for that. You need to sign up to get your Muni Lifeline discount. Or if you're a free Muni for youth, you sign up to get that. So it would be a sign up. And then you would have the fast track device that corresponds with what the benefit you've signed up for.
Since the city has many parking garages within the proposed boundaries, will prices go up as a way of further deterring driving or go down to lessen the overall charges to drivers?
Well, that's a good question. I think there's probably a lot of nuances and issues within that very question. I think, you know, something that the city does control is the parking tax. You know, the rates of private garages or employer garages, the city doesn't have control over. The city has control of the parking tax, or if it's a city-owned garage, the parking rates. So I think there's multiple very good questions in that question about considering the total cost, you know, of someone's drive trip downtown. And I'm not sure if I can sum it up very neatly.
Let's see, we got looking back here. If enacted, how often will there be an evaluation of the number of vehicles entering the zone and the amount of pollution in the zone? And will people have to re-register as far as the their discounts?
Right. Very good question. Well, London did an annual evaluation, I think, for the first 5 years, they did an annual evaluation. And I think since then, it hasn't necessarily been every year that I have seen. Something like requirements about evaluation and re-registration and things like that, those are things that would need to be specified in the authorizing legislation.
I'm just wondering, Bob Plantheld, do you have any specific questions you want to bring up at this point?
No, I've said what I thought helpful to lay out the issue. And, you know, you asked some of my questions. I want to get back to something that I said, though, that I want the TA staff to think about. If and when there's a significant fee imposed, and by significant, I mean $12.50, will you be doing any study to see if there suddenly arises a whole lot of people suddenly trying to park around Church and Market just outside the western boundary, or, you know, just north of Market, just outside the northern boundary, and then taking Muni in and parking in such a way that suddenly you get a lot of people filling up the parking spaces, the driveways, the streets, just outside those zones? As they say, yes, that happened with West Portal some years ago. And, yeah, you know, people figuratively got really upset at West Portal, understandably. Will you be able to do any sort of calculation study, you know, visual count analysis about that possibility?
We absolutely will. Yeah. And yes.
I think we've
I'm saying it's going to be something I suggest you make a note that ought to be a to-do task, like a year or two after that. You say you don't let it sneak up on you, catch it and bite you in the, you know, sensitive areas.
Yeah, I agree, Bob. I think that's a very good point that needs to be emphasized. Yeah, I agree with you.
Well, I think we've answered most of the questions, or they were covered during the talk. There are a couple of questions that are in the chat regarding Muni and the various trial lines. Those are governed by MTA, not the CTA. So that's another question for the Muni folks. But, Rachel, thank you very much for nonstop being on the spot here for an hour and almost an hour and a half. We must be ready for the one.
Dennis and other Sharp folks, I really appreciate you having us and taking all the time to have this discussion. And hopefully, you know, we can come back maybe in a few months and give you an update and appreciate it.
A lot of interest. I think it's the most questions we've ever had at the end of a talk of any of our Zoom meetings.
Happy to do it.
Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you, Rachel. And thank you, Paige, for checking with us.
Thank you. Thank you for having us. And we'll be in touch.
Thanks a lot.
Bye-bye.
Good night, all.